Okay. So I have no comments on the midterm for, as I stated, two reasons. One is that I've seen that they're in a box in my office, but that's as close as I've gotten to them. And that took me a little bit to even notice the box, which I nearly tripped over. But, you know, so that's something. The other is that I have a couple of students who still have yet to take it. With any luck at all, I will have them graded by Wednesday. But it's a daunting task. Of course, we have no class on Friday. I'm always tempted not to announce that in class just to see who shows up. But I've found that the one thing that everybody does learn quickly is when to recognize when there are holidays. And it was always a shock to me that Washington recognized Veterans Day as a holiday. The East Coast doesn't so much. I do hope to have that. I will be also assigning projects in the next week or so. These are group projects where I assign who you will work with. It is probably more the rule that you don't know the other people who are on your group rather than you already do. I try to get biostatisticians separated across groups. We don't have enough biostatisticians for every group, and so then I also tend to take people who are biostatistician wannabes. There are several in the class, the people who are planning on applying for biostatistics. I take people if I happen to know they have a biostatistics background, and I put them in that. But I also separate the epidemiologists across all of the groups. So usually a group will have a biostatistician and an epidemiologist. And, there's enough global health people that they now warrants being separated. So I do go and look at these things. But the goal is, in fact, as my wife says, it used to be people would say, can I just work by myself? And my wife would say, no, make them learn how to work with other people. So that is a key goal. So those will be signed. There will be two different projects that you will be signed to one or the other. Eventually, you will be reviewing papers on the topic that you are not writing a paper on. So, questions on that? Yes.
Friday section with the day off, what do you want us to do? Are we supposed to come on Monday?
I can't require it. If I could, I probably would. But the idea, I'll record one, but the recording these doesn't work super well. How many of you think that I say anything just once? I didn't think so. So, you know, I mean, the idea is, I personally think it's preferable if you come to it, but it's not the end of the world if you can't come to Monday or Tuesday. Tuesday is the least visited discussion section. There's always plenty of room. But I will record Wednesdays. And the trouble is with the recording is you sometimes hear my voice and you almost never hear the comments of the other people. So it doesn't work real well. Other questions? Homework will be assigned on Wednesday and due the next Wednesday. You get a whole week with no homework. You'll note that I discount the midterm entirely in that statement that you're supposed to like this idea. Aren't I magnanimous, you know? Okay. We were talking about Kant's intervals, and we talked about the idea that, again, the confidence interval is formed by X bar, which estimates mu, X bar plus or minus this critical value times the standard error. And the standard error is the variability of the sample mean across repeated studies. Sigma is the variability of X within one study, or within the population. Sigma over the square root of n is the variability of X bar calculated across repeated studies. We don't usually do repeated studies. We usually do one, but it's a neat trick of statistics that I can do one study and get a pretty good estimate of what would have happened if I'd repeated my study over and over again. Notice that I can't totally say what my X bar would have been in other situations, but I can talk about what sigma, what my variability would have been. Now, the sample mean is normally distributed in a large enough sample size. So this formula will hold in any large sample size. But the trouble with this formula is we usually don't know sigma. We have to estimate it. So we'll use a sample standard deviation to estimate the population standard deviation. Now, when you make that estimate in large enough samples, you can just substitute that estimate. In statistical terms, the key thing that we're using is we're using Slutsky's theorem. So you may not know what Slutsky's theorem is yet. You will. And that Slutsky's theorem is basically says, if you have something that you don't know what it is, you can substitute in a consistent estimate of it, and it works in large samples. And so that's really what we're doing. Our sample variance in large enough samples will be consistent for the true population variance. And so sometimes we just go ahead and throw in that estimate without doing any particular adjustment. We just do it. But if we had normally distributed data, then we know exactly what to do. And because mathematicians sort of dreamed up this test first, and when they were confronted with the problem and people said, I want to test my sample mean and talk about what the population mean is. And their first answer was, well, I don't know what to do about that. You know. But then in the true mathematical thing is, well, you just make some assumptions. It's like, you know, Alabaman chicken farmer who was not getting enough eggs out of his chickens and so went to the university and went to the mathematician and said, can you help me on how to, you know, get better egg production? And the guy said, yeah, go away, come back in a week and I'll see what I can do. So the farmer comes back in a week, goes to the mathematician, says, well, do you have a solution for me? He goes, I think so. He goes, here, just have a seat. Goes up to the board and said, first, let's postulate a spherical chicken. Well, this is this concept of what they did is they said, I don't know how to solve the problem in general, but if you had normal data, I know how to solve that problem, and they derived these results. So there's a lot of the books that you'll see that will start out and say, assume you have normal distribution, and they'll do all this nice math. The key point is we later found out, you know what, even if you don't have normal data, this works fine in large samples. So this is why I suppress the normality, but it lives on right here. It lives on in this small sample adjustment. We got into the habit. We got into the habit of pretending that we had normal data and doing all sorts of things. We never got burned by it because it works in large samples. We never stopped doing it because it didn't go wrong. There's plenty of statistics that have been devised that we got burned by, so we stopped doing it. This one we didn't. So because the correct thing to do if you had normal distributions was to use the sample standard deviation and then use the T distribution. We do that all the time, even when we don't think we have normal data. So it's just a habit. Generally behaves well in other settings. So we just use a T critical value. That T critical value depends upon the degrees of freedom. That N minus 1 is the degrees of freedom. But it also depends upon alpha. The degrees of freedom are related to the sample size. Usually it's the sample size minus the number of parameters used to estimate the mean. In one sample, we're only estimating one mean, so it's N minus 1. In two samples, there's two means, so we use N minus 2. When you get into multiple regression, there are, of course, P parameters, so we use N minus P. And actually, the idea is I just let the software do it because they know what to do. The difference between the T distribution and normal distribution is the the t-distribution has heavier tails, but as n goes to infinity, it turns into the normal distribution. The t-distribution with 1 degree of freedom is a very bad distribution called the Cauchy. And so the critical values are extremely large, extremely far away. And in fact, the Cauchy is used in our curriculum just to torture our graduate students. It, you know, isn't something that we care about except for giving problems that are difficult to deal with. But the idea is, as you get to any sort of a reasonable sample size, our critical values quickly approach the 1.96 that's used so often for the normal distribution. To get the confidence intervals from Stata, we use the command CI when we have a one sample situation. So we say CI in a variable, and it knows obviously what you want is you want the mean. You want a confidence interval for the mean, and level tells you what probability level confidence interval you want. If you have what we call sufficient statistics, there's something called a sufficient statistic that says you don't need all of the data if you have just these few statistics. So sometimes when you're reading a paper, you'll read what a mean and a standard deviation is and a sample size, and we can just give those three numbers and get the confidence interval. So that's what CII is. Stata has a lot of these immediate commands that you just give sufficient statistics. There is a complicated definition to the word sufficiency. We are going to come to doing tests, and Stata is very nice in that it gives you automatically the confidence intervals you might have when you do tests. So really, that's how I get the confidence intervals most often, because most often I want to do the test at the same time. So we could look at the FEV in smokers. Here I said, for both non-smokers and smokers, I want a confidence interval for FEV. And by default, this is the 95% confidence interval, and it gives me this output. It tells me that for non-smokers, I have 589 observations, the mean is 2.57, the standard error is 0.04, and the 95% confidence interval is 2.50 to 2.63. For smokers, there's only 65 of them. They have a higher FEV of 3.28. They have a higher standard error as well. Why do they have a higher standard error? Fewer observations, that's probably the major one here. It's sigma over square root of n. But we've also seen that the FEV is more variable in the older age groups. Is somewhat of a mean variance relationship. And so the sigma that's being estimated, the sample, you know, the sample standard deviation is also likely larger among those kids. Although it's a complicated thing to be able to say, within each age group, there's going to be a higher standard deviation. But of course, because there are more age groups than the other, we might see the larger standard deviation there too. So both of them can contribute, but the sample size is a big one here. So it tells us that the best estimate of the mean FEV, 2.57 liters per second in non-smokers, 3.28 liters per second in smokers. Jargon. I just love this jargon, right? 95% confident that the true mean is between 2.50 liters per second and 2.63 liters per second. Non-smokers, and in smokers, we're 95% confident the true mean is between 3.09 and 3.46 liters per second. And what the hell does that mean? What does it mean that 95% confident? So the correct interpretation of a confidence interval is very, very important, and 99 out of 100 people get it wrong. Okay. So one correct interpretation of the confidence interval that's extremely boring. If I repeated this experiment many, 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 many times and computed a confidence interval each time,
95% of those confidence intervals would cover the true mean. Okay? So this is like the, I think I've told you all the, about the person flying into Seattle in a private airplane. And they're running out of fuel, and there's this bad fog bank, and they're hopelessly lost and can't find SeaTac. So as they're flying by, this building suddenly yells out and goes, "Where am I?" And the guy answers back, "You're in an airplane." And the pilot immediately banked 60 degrees. A few minutes later, landed at SeaTac just as his plane sputtered out of fuel. And the passenger in the plane goes, "God, you're an amazing pilot. I mean, hopelessly lost." And the guy, you know, just gives you that answer. And immediately, you know, he goes, "How'd you do it? How'd you do it?" He goes, "Oh, it's easy. You know, I asked the question, and the person gave me an answer that's just 100% accurate, but also 100% useless." I said, "Well, that's the Microsoft support office." I said, "From there, you just bank 60 years." You never see that in time at all. So this is correct. This is correct. It provides no knowledge scientifically. So this is describing this idea. This is a forest plot. You'll see forest plots like this lots of times in scientific manuscripts where they're doing meta-analyses, where they're producing statistics from many different studies and saying, look, this is what you see. And all those confidence intervals have a 95% chance of covering the truth. But what you see is, if the true mean is 3.2, I'm pretending that I knew that. Well, actually, I did know that because I made up this data. So the true mean was 3.2, and I did repeated analyses, computed the confidence intervals, and you see most of them cover the truth, but not all of them. But what's the trick there? Well, the trick is every single study has a different confidence interval. So I'm not talking about the confidence interval we obtained this time. I'm talking about the different confidence intervals I would have gotten if I'd done different studies. How does that help? Where does this 95% coverage tell you how to interpret the numbers I got this time? So I don't like this definition of confidence interval. I mean, it is the definition. I sometimes use it as I do my statistical research to judge the accuracy of my statistical research. But it didn't tell me anything about the numbers 3.09 and 3.46, okay? But I want to know, what do the numbers 3.09 and 3.46 mean? Well, this one's wrong, and this is what most people think it means. And this is what Bayesians like to make fun of frequentists for, because they say, oh, you ask anybody what a confidence interval is, and they're going to give you this definition, and it's wrong. This definition. The probability is 95% that the true mean is between 3.09 and 3.46. What's the difference between this statement and the prior statement I made that was correct? The prior statement didn't use the numbers 3.09 and 3.46. It just said, you got a confidence interval. Your process of getting a confidence interval has a 95% chance of covering the true mean. That's true. But the second that I put the numbers 3.09 and 3.46 in there, what's the probability that it covers the true mean?
Zero or one.
It either does cover the true mean or it doesn't. Which one is it? Who knows? The meaning of the 95% is, of all confidence intervals that I create, 95% of the time, the probability is one that it covers the mean. And 5% of the time, the probability is zero, it covers the mean. This interpretation is just wrong. This is a Bayesian interpretation. And it would work if I told you the prior. If I gave you a prior of saying, you know what, I think the true mean is 3.1 with a distribution that ranges from 0 to 14.7. Okay, I could make up something like that and do it and come up with this interpretation. So this isn't the right interpretation. The best one. The sample mean that we observed, 3.28, is typical of what we expect if the true mean were anywhere between 3.09 and 3.46. So it's a statement about the data that you observed. I observed 3.28. When do I expect to observe 3.28? I expect to observe 3.28 if the truth is between 3.09 and 3.46. Okay, what do I mean by I expect to observe it? I don't know. It's the central 95%. So that's my definition of what's typical. That the 95% in the 95% confidence interval is, I say that for every hypothesized mean, I'm going to take the central 95% of the things that you might observe, and then I'll call that typical. And if the true mean was 3.05, 3.28 is too unusual. If the true mean were 3.50, 3.28 is not typical. But if it's 3.09, well, 3.28 happens at least 2.5% of the time. So I call it typical. This is the thing that I will push. You write up a very careful definition of a confidence interval. You submit it to a science writer. They will botch your sentence. They will say, this reads like garbage. I mean, you know, this is terrible. Wouldn't it be so much nicer if we changed these words around? Don't let them, okay? You have to explain that statistics is beautiful in its own right, and so you don't have to have good prose. So we have these two confidence intervals. Now, here's the other thing that I have to look at. The two confidence intervals do not overlap. Many of you are going to be encouraged by parties that I won't name, but they teach EPI 512, 513, to often look at two confidence intervals and say they don't overlap, we know what's significant. Like most simple statements, there's an element of truth to it sometimes, but it's more complicated than that. So there is no true value of the mean that would typically lead to both of these observations. We've got a multiple comparison issue here, though, that we have to worry about. So we have to think about it. If my groups are independent, this finding is sufficient to say that there's a statistically significant difference, but it's not necessary. You can sometimes have non-overlapping confidence intervals from independent groups and still have a statistically significant difference between them. So if the two groups are dependent, if you are looking at, say, I first took everybody when they were non-smokers, and then they started smoking, and 5 years later I calculated what their FEV was after they were smoking, so that those are dependent, I can't promise anything, because that correlation between the two groups can make it so that even if they don't overlap, it's possible that now there's not a statistically significant difference between the groups. Okay? So here, we can take this very simple rule that if you remember about five additional rules, you know how to interpret it sometimes, or you can just learn the real way to do this. Okay? We're going to focus on the real way to do this, which is whenever you can answer your question with one confidence interval, do it. So if your interest is in the difference between non-smokers and smokers, what we will eventually do is we will compute an estimate of the difference in the means and give a confidence interval for the difference in the means. And we will not get into the habit of looking at the two different confidence intervals and using that as the judge. There is sometimes that elevator statistics is all right. And somebody hands you a paper, and they can say, there's a significant difference, and you can say, well, they were independent groups and they don't overlap, so we know it's significant, but we don't know what the p-value is. But there will be other times that'll say, they do overlap, but maybe they're statistically significant, maybe they aren't. So we will always try to get just one confidence interval. Okay, then we can do tests. So we test hypotheses that the true mean is in some particular range. Our null hypothesis is usually the status quo, what we will tend to believe unless we prove otherwise. We are terrible at proving that something is true in statistics, but we're pretty good at proving that something is false. So if you just go around making false statements, I can help you. If you go around making true statements, I can't do very much. So What we tend to do most often is we say a treatment doesn't have an effect. Something is not a risk factor for disease, and then we try to establish that it is a beneficial treatment or it is an important risk factor. So our null hypothesis is what we hope to disprove. Our alternative hypothesis is what we hope is true. And that hope is true. Always when I talk about hope is true, of course, I'm focusing on me. It's always about me. And what I hope is true is that I can get another publication on my CV. I mean, it would be nice if, in fact, you know, being exposed to, the malaria did not make you sick. But I get a line on my CV if I demonstrate that the organism does cause malaria, so therefore I hope it's true. Right? It's a very, very bad situation to be in. Working in clinical trials where you're saying, we were unlucky, not enough people died, so we didn't have much precision. And try not to say that public very often. You know? As we do this inference, we can do a one-sided test of a greater alternative, that my null hypothesis is that mu is less than or equal to mu naught versus an alternative that mu is greater than or equal to mu 1, which is greater than mu naught. Now, I work in experimental design experiments, so I almost always have an alternative in my mind of what I hope is true, is that the effect is at least as large as mu 1. So I don't just say what you'll see is, well, the estimate is that it's zero or less, or that it's greater than zero. I actually go ahead and say, I've got to be targeting on how much bigger than mu zero I think it is. And the same with the one-sided test of a lesser alternative. And then sometimes we don't care about the direction. It's enough to prove that something's going on. So you're testing a new drug against placebo, and you are you're measuring the mean residual life. Right? And what you're hoping is the new drug will lead to longer life. We don't care about proving that the new drug causes you to die early. And so usually we'd be at a one-sided test for a greater alternative. Sometimes, rather than talking about how long you live, we talk about the probability that you will die. And we're hoping that that probability is lower. So we would talk about a one-sided test of a lesser alternative. But sometimes I'm testing, instead of a new drug against placebo or standard of care, I'm testing two existing drugs. You know, aspirin and ibuprofen. How do they do at treating inflammation? Well, I could be interested in, is aspirin better than ibuprofen? Is ibuprofen better than aspirin? Or are they about the same? That will move me into the two-sided hypothesis test. Sometimes it happens, and classic case is the Women's Initiative or the CARROT study about beta carotene. Sometimes it happens that we are really looking at a therapy that's a new indication, so that you would take hormone therapy to prevent heart disease. That's a new indication. We had all these women who were taking hormone therapy to prevent menopausal symptoms, but we had this new indication. Even though that was being done against placebo, scientifically, we were interested in the two-sided hypothesis test because there was a difference between saying, take hormone therapy if it prevents heart attacks, between saying, you know what, hormone therapy doesn't prevent heart attacks. But, you know, if it's relieving menopausal symptoms, then fine, take it. Or the situation that we really found ourselves in, hormone therapy actually causes heart attacks. And so then we had to, even though it was a new indication, there was the ethical imperative to actually prove harm because we'd say something different. But most times we don't do something to prove harm. Most times we just look at proving benefit or saying there isn't substantial benefit. So choosing one-sided versus two-sided, what will change your behavior, new treatment versus placebo? Usually we do the one-sided test because it's only important to detect that the treatment is an improvement. Whereas if it's an existing treatment versus placebo, we might have to discriminate between those situations. Will we push the new treatment if it's better? We're neutral. It's already out there for other things, but we don't have to warn you about the safeties. or will warn against the new treatment of worst. And by the way, the beta carotene also did this, that the belief was that beta carotene would prevent cancer and cause longer survival. And actually, in the two large clinical trials, it was found to increase the rate of cancer and cause more mortality. So then what we do is we compute the frequentist p-value. And what the p-value is the probability of observing as or more extreme results if the null hypothesis were true. So basically, you and I get in an argument. You say a treatment doesn't work. I say it does. And I end up doing an experiment, and I see, so there. If you were right, I shouldn't have gotten this data. Well, how do I know that? Because the probability of getting this data was less than 5%. If you were right. It's a backwards question. I'm not telling you the probability that you're right or the probability that I'm right. I'm telling you the probability of getting data like this. Now, this is, of course, where Bayesians say that we're just stupid. Because they said, but you got this data. I mean, we know the probability of getting this data. It's sitting right there. You know, you see it? But we were talking about, but if the other person had been right. Science is adversarial. If the other person was right, then we shouldn't have gotten this data. And we're putting a whole lot on designing smart experiments. It needs to be adversarial. It needs to be two intelligent people arguing before you can trust the p-value very much. If two stupid people are arguing about this, then the probability that you would or would not have gotten this data isn't really telling you anything about whether this is now a reasonable hypothesis. So in the lower one-sided p-value, we've observed X bar, capital X bar, the random variable, the idea of doing the experiment and measuring the sample mean. And we've observed little X bar, the data that we got right now. And so we look at the probability, if the null hypothesis was true, if mu equaled mu zero, what's the probability that we would have gotten a sample mean at least as low as that that we observed? If we were testing an upper alternative, then we would calculate, what's the probability of getting a sample mean at least as large as what we observed? And if you do the tighter p-value, the mathematics becomes harder to look at. Absolute values, yeah, we don't like them. But we use them all the time. And so we just look at the probability of getting those random variables. Often we can compute the two-sided p-value as computing both the lower one-sided p-value and the upper one-sided p-value, taking the smaller number and multiply by two. So often it turns into that simple approach. Of course, to compute that, we generally use the t-distribution, just as we did with the confidence intervals. And so the p-values that are returned by the statistical software are using the t-distribution with n minus 1 degrees of freedom in this one sample case. And notice that I say the two-sided p-value is just 2 times the one-sided p-value, where I purposely chose the one that would make it positive. So it took the absolute value. Stata gives you everything you want quite easily. Okay, so not really easily. Not if you're really going to go do the t-prob, but why do the t-prob? So you can do it. You can get the probability by saying t-prob with the degrees of freedom and your number, and it returns the two-sided p-value. But it's so much easier if you ask Stata to go ahead and compute the sample mean and the sample variance and n and do everything all at once. Just use t-test. And so you use t-test, you have your variable, whatever your variable name is, and then you give the number. So number value is actually the number that you would put in there. Most often, we want that to be 0. And so that's the default. Most often, we're doing tests with 0. I will note that we don't really do the one sample t-test very often unless we're testing differences in something. And so that's why 0 would be relevant. So, in this case, show examples with a one sample t-test. Why we learn the one sample t-test is really more to talk about what all the other tests are. So it's always sort of artificial as I try to cook up something and say, so what would I look at here? Well, if I go to the PSA data set and I want to test that the mean nadir PSA is 15, so among a population of men who you might treat hormonally for their prostate cancer, and then you measure the lowest value that their PSA goes to afterwards, is that mean 15? Where did I come up with that number? I mean, that it should have been a question that I'd asked before ever looking at my data that I had some reason. I don't have any reason at all except for the purpose of showing what the state output is here. So I said t-test nadir equals 15. It tells me I had 50 observations. It tells me my variable was nadir, that the mean was 16.36, the standard error 5.55. Tells me the t-statistic is 2.95. Finally, it gets to something that I care about. It gives me the p-value is 0.005 and a confidence interval 5.21 to 7.51. Now, the first thing I have to point out is this p-value that it gives on this line is a test that nadir is equal to 0. That's just what it does by default. That 2.95, if you get out your calculators and do it, you will find that 16.36 divided by 5.55 is 2.95. That's all it's doing. So that is the test for a mean of 0. Very often people want that test, but they didn't know what else to put there, so they just put something down. The real test that the mean is 15 appears on the bottom, but they didn't know whether you were testing a one-sided lower alternative, a one-sided upper alternative, or a two-sided test. So the lower alternative was that the mean, that the true mean was less than 15, is on the left. That the true mean was greater than 15 is on the right. And the two-sided test is in the middle. You'll see that the two-sided test is double the smaller of the two p-values. So we have the one-sided upper p-value was 0.4037. The one-sided lower p-value was 0.5963. The two-sided 0.8075 is 2 times 0.4037, because that's the smaller number. That's what we will usually see, but I'll just say that when we get to discrete data, it won't be quite that, but it'll be close. Deciding what it is, here's the other simple rule. If your sample mean is bigger than your hypothesis, then the upper p-value should be less than 0.5, and the lower p-value should be greater. So you just look to say, you know, if you've observed a sample mean that's bigger than your hypothesis, then the chance that it's less than what you observed is quite logically determined. You just would expect that if I were trying to prove that the mean nadir was less than 15 and I observed a mean that was greater than 16, obviously I don't have very much evidence that the true mean is less than 15. So these observed results are not atypical of those that might be obtained when the true mean is 15, p equals 0.81. Based on these results, we cannot, with 95% confidence, reject the hypothesis that the true mean is 15. How did I know that? Because my p-value was greater than 0.05. So that's why I said 95% confidence. We can reject with 95% confidence that the true population mean is less than 5.21 or greater than 27.51. That was just the confidence. Confidence intervals and tests are, there's what we call the duality of hypothesis tests, tests and confidence intervals, that you can interpret every confidence interval as a test if you want. As a general rule, if our confidence interval does not include our null hypothesis, then the test that we would use would have rejected that null hypothesis. The exceptions that I have to say are that sometimes we use a different statistic to do our test than we use to make our confidence interval. But we just have to watch. And that almost always comes up around the mean variance relationship that I'll be talking a lot about more later. These one-sample tests are easily extended to other settings, tests of geometric means, tests for changes in paired samples, and the tests comparing two independent samples are going to look very much the same, so that's why we were focusing on this a lot. Questions on this? So we'll go to those extensions. Now, these next few lectures, I sort of view as just beating you into submission. Hopefully, you will see that all I'm doing is the exact same thing over and over and over again, except when it comes to interpreting the confidence interval, I change a few words here and there. And so much so that you see that I just change a few words here and there that sometimes I forget to change a few here and there, and you know, you get the cut and paste mistakes. But actually, there's something useful in seeing that that's really what we're doing. That I'm going to do other inference, but instead of just talking about the mean, it'll be the mean difference. Or it'll be inference for a binomial proportion. Or it'll be inference for a Poisson rate. Or it'll be inference for a geometric mean. But those will be the words that I'll be just changing. It's rather than saying the mean FEV was between these values, I'll say the geometric mean FEV was between these. Or the probability of having an FEV greater than 5 was between these values. It's this concept that I'm just changing that summary measure. Otherwise, we're doing the same thing over and over and over again. So, what about match samples? Previously, I considered the mean of a distribution within a single group. Very limited application because we rarely have some absolute hypothesis about what the value of the population parameter would be. In fact, the standard of needing to have a control, right? There's only two sorts of researchers in the world, those with a lot of enthusiasm and no controls, and those with a lot of controls and no enthusiasm. Well, the reason why we have the controls is because we don't trust gathering one sample and knowing what number it should have been. We always want to have our control population. So the one case, though, where I can say I'm going to compare something as a one-sample test is when that something is a measurement that's a difference or a ratio between paired observations. So the standard error of a sample mean from independent variables depends upon the variance of measurements within a group and the sample size. So the standard error of y bar is the square root of the variance of yi divided by n. Differences in means across groups can be estimated by the mean difference. This is this double expectation formula, or the linearity of expectation. Comparisons within a pair of positively correlated subjects leads to greater precision. We're adjusting for a highly predictive random effect. So by taking two measurements on me and finding their difference, so you're going to take it when I'm doing exercise, take it when I'm in transcendental meditation, and you're going to find out by within me, using my own control, as to the relative merits of transcendental meditation and exercise and reducing blood pressure. And I'm going to do the same thing on each of you. And I'm going to do this a good randomized experiment because half of us will first do transcendental meditation and the other half will first do exercise. So it'll be randomized, but I have these comparisons. And because each of us have different blood pressures routinely, I gain more precision. Rather than comparing my blood pressure to your blood pressure and having to live with the interperson variability, I'll just get the intraperson variability. So I'll take the variance of W minus X as the variance of W plus the variance of X minus 2 times the correlation, and blood pressure is positively correlated. So I'm subtracting off some positive number. I've got a smaller variance for the difference there. If I take this difference across positively correlated, if we just did this independent, you put me on transcendental meditation and you on exercise randomly, Well, I've got the variance of W plus the variance of X, but I don't subtract off anything else. That's a bigger standard error. So this is why we naturally do paired experiments, why we think to do it. This is the mathematical explanation for what you guys already knew, right? Wouldn't you get more precision if you made comparisons within individuals? So many studies make use of these matched samples. We do crossover studies in which each subject receives both treatments in random order, and that is key. We do not trust results that you don't do it in random order. We do split plot designs. This comes out of agriculture, but in people, we might apply a treatment to one eye and the other treatment to the other eye. In dermatology, we might apply it to one arm and another treatment to the other arm. And then sometimes we have matched subjects, twin studies, matched communities, or so on. Something that said, here are two subjects that are correlated at some level, and we will make certain that the treatment is applied to each one. And then we'll do our comparisons within those matched groups. So we collapse data on subjects. This is the easiest way to deal with correlated data when you can do it. So you just take a single measurement on each subject by taking a difference between them. The subjects are independent, and so we've sort of removed the probability that the repeated measurements made on the individuals are not independent. And then we end up just taking those paired differences, living with the fact that the difference of means is the same as the mean difference, and we find out what our we create a new variable that is the difference, and we say that's the thing that has mean u and variance sigma squared. So we'll continue here on Wednesday.